Welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, Season 8. Now, before we begin, we cannot forget that we live and work in Skwepakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Skwepak people. Every day, it becomes clear that doing the best we can to resolve this historical injustice is a critical responsibility for all of us. Now, today we are welcoming someone to Food Conversation who has parlayed foraging and baking skills and also an aptitude for and sensitivity to human relations and a talent for teaching into a successful local business that produces baked goods with unique foraged ingredients. Amanda Kilbourne is the owner and operator of Forest and Food Fixation, and we're delighted to have her with us in the studio today. Welcome, Amanda, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're delighted. We're delighted. And I thought we could start off with a name. It's not often that you see the word fixation in a business title. Why is that word there? How did that word get in there?
I think that when I get interested in something, I get pretty fixated on it, hyper-fixated even. So my involvement in the forest and foraging is definitely a fixation of mine.
Since a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yes, I noticed that the Economic Development Society kind of made a coy little mention of it. They said the name of your company, Forest and Food Fixation, and said, it's almost like a fixation.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they picked up on that. But that goes back a long time in your life, to early years when you were a kid, and
yeah.
You lived in Cambridge, Ontario, which is an interesting town. The hospital there is quite famous for having introduced environmental measures years ago, before many other hospitals. I happen to know because the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment that I'm part of. Anyway, they used it there, but this is the pattern that's been there for a long time. Now, Your parents weren't involved in that sort of thing, although your father actually foraged mushrooms when he was a kid, I understand. Did you know that at the time? I mean, was that thing he did, or did it come out later?
That came up later. Mm-hmm. We went camping a lot when I was younger, almost, to my memory, constantly, as many trips as we could fit into a summer. And I always found other things to pick in the woods, like berries and strawberries and wild fruits and stuff. Anything that I could recognize and help.
Anything that moved, bugs
and, yes,
and little critters.
Yes, when I was younger, my fixation was a bit more on insects. I would collect monarch caterpillars and raise them into butterflies. I would go turning over logs and find salamanders and toads. And I'm really just fascinated with all of the anything that's out
you
in nature.
You had a toad sanctuary.
I did, yes.
What is a toad sanctuary for our listeners?
It was a little box enclosure that I had in the backyard, an empty bottom, so that if they needed to, they could escape. Uh-huh. But anytime my parents were doing yard work or mowing the lawn, I could go and collect the toads running away from the mower, put them safely in their nice little habitat there. And then they
would your parents slow the lawnmower down in order to give you a chance to get
out?
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's good. I like a cooperative arrangement.
Yeah,
that's much better. And your dad used mushrooms, and I believe still does, use them for medicinal purpose, making
that's actually more something in the last 5-10 years, or 5 years or so. He collects chaga back in Ontario. It's pretty prevalent there. Turkey tail as well. And he makes tinctures with them. And I usually get a nice little vial for Christmas, and I put it in my coffee for the rest of the year.
Now, everybody who collects mushrooms has to know which mushroom looks like which. I get the willies when I think about going out and picking a mushroom and then having a very bad stomach ache or killing a friend or something like that. Do you ever have those anxieties, or are you confident enough now that you know what's worth it?
I'm confident enough now in the fact that I'm not going to risk things. So if you are ever in doubt at all, if you're not 100-some-odd% sure, and you've done all your background, then don't, just throw it out. It's not going to, it's not worth the risk.
Mother Nature will reuse it. She's much better at recycling than we are.
Yes, exactly.
Now, your mom worked with children, so sort of, in what capacity exactly? Was it sort of educational or?
My mom works with children with and the families of children with autism and Down syndrome and other associative mental functions.
Yeah.
and learning resources and stuff.
Yeah, that, we'll talk about it a little bit later, because you've brought in some sensitivity to people in the way you run your business, which is an interesting thing. When you were growing up, your parents were involved with an organization called the Vineyard Church Movement, which mostly in the United States, but in Canada as well, but also had a very active role in Brazil, and we'll talk about that in a moment as well. But after you left school, you went to George Brown College.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I looked up George Brown. Other people have mentioned George Brown College. It's a gigantic operation.
Yeah.
And I was looking at the list of alumni, and they seem to be either in the food movement in some way, or they're in the movies, actors and actresses. Is that why you went there? Because it had a profile as being if you're going to get into food and be a chef in some way, this is a place to go to.
It was just offering courses that were more geared towards what I was looking for in the food industry, and it had good a reputation. I think it was recommended to me by somebody as well, as being a higher, you know, I was only 20-something going into that. I wasn't significantly educated on what schools were the best, but I'm glad I did.
But it had a profile. It had a profile. Yeah. The number of courses is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the other thing about it is that it's part of a movement to help people learn about pragmatic skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things you do where you combine knowledge and science with doing things, which, of course, what food is all a lot of food science. I mean, food's got a lot of science embedded in it. You know, how long you let dough rest and that kind of thing is all based on scientific principles. But it's something where you learn a pragmatic or useful skill, as opposed to more intellectual development. It's combining intellectual with actual practical. How long is the course that you were taking?
It's only 2 years, which was also nice. So I'm not stuck in school for a decade or however long, and ranking up that bill. It was a smaller course and affordable. My school's all paid off by now already. Great. and it's been useful for everyday life, let alone starting a business. It was a business management course as well, so there was some business aspects.
Yes,
to it
I saw too. There were two courses around baking and pastry arts. There was baking, pastry arts, which I guess you did baking and pastry, and then there was the management. And which of the two, when you set up your own business, which was the one, I mean, were they equal or was
it wasn't
one...
two courses? It was all at once. So
oh,
maybe
part of
now
one
they've,
unit?
They've separated it now. Into two, but at the time it was baking and pastry arts management. So
you realize you had to, if you're going to run a business, you got to know what you're doing.
Well, at that time I wasn't planning on running a business. No. Many people told me I should, but I just wanted to go learn how to work with chocolate.
So why did why did people tell you that? Did they sense something in you?
I don't know. Possibly.
In retrospect, do you think that they could see that you had an aptitude for kind of managing a project?
Probably.
Now, your mom's and father's involvement in the Vineyard Church Movement—that they were very—that organization is very involved with churches in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, around 20-ish odd, you went off to Brazil. And
I did.
Part of this, but also on your own. What did you do there, and what you were kind of immersed into a task?
Yes.
And what was that task?
Well, I was told I was going to be coming to be a homeschool helper. So in my mind, that means somebody assisting the teacher. And I found out very quickly when I got there that I was the teacher. And I'd never taught before. So that was quite a jump for me.
It was like
20.
Jumping into the deep end of the swimming pool.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so I didn't panic. Well, maybe I did a little bit. But I was like, okay, well, I guess that's what I'm doing now, and I figured it out.
Yeah, and what was that like? I understand the kids were 5 and 7.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
It was challenging. I think one of the more challenging things was finding motivation. So, you know, gearing these kids that don't really want to sit down and read, and it's hard, and they, you know, finding ways of getting them engaged and keeping them interested, and helping them actually progress and learn those tools.
So why don't you give us an example, say with money?
Yes. I so my 7-year-old was learning about math and multiplication tables and things. So she understood that if you had a bunch of grapes, that could equal 10 grapes. And so if you'd add two of those together, that's 20. But as soon as you converted that to money, a 10-cent coin, she's like, no, there's one of those. That doesn't make any sense. So they brought out a table of their toys and some new objects for them to buy and gave them exact dollar or coin amounts that they had to give me using coins in front of them. They picked it up immediately. Suddenly they didn't care anymore that the 10 cents doesn't look like 10 things. They're like, no, well, I know it's 10. So now, and that motivation was found.
A little visual goes a long way, a little pragmatic stuff. What was it like being exposed to Brazilian culture? I know it wasn't your central role, but you were there and there are a lot of Brazilian people. Seeing a whole different culture.
It's pretty much as soon as I would be done with school teachings for the day, I'd be off in the Brazilian culture as much as possible. And I didn't speak really any Portuguese before going there. So I would spend a lot of time in environments where I can't communicate properly with anybody. A lot of hand signaling, a lot of gesturing. And I did have one or two friends that spoke English quite fluently, and one that taught English. So I'd help her out in the schools. And another environment where I just had to listen and pay attention, and I eventually did learn Portuguese after about 3 months.
Which is pretty good, pretty astonishing. In only 3 months.
Yeah.
A lot of people take 10 years to really learn another language. I'm not saying you learn, to read and write literature and stuff like that.
To get by. That I could go to the store by myself and buy myself a sandwich and it would be fine.
And you knew how much the money was worth.
Yeah, exactly.
Take the kids with you. See, I can do it too. Now, early work was when you got back to Canada, and I guess it would be in Toronto, was working in retail and a coffee shop kind of environment. Why don't you talk about, I think the job that seemed to be your principal job was working in a coffee shop, and the owner there was some baking and stuff going on.
Yeah, it was a coffee shop in Toronto, and the owner really liked to play around. So he nearly fired you. He did after the first week. Luckily, he talked to his brother.
His brother.
Has quite a bit of experience in running and managing kitchens. And he was going to fire me because I was a little slow for the job he had hired me for. I wasn't used to line work. I wasn't used to that level of quickness and demand.
Yeah.
But I just came from pastry school. So I knew how to do develop recipes and things like that. So he had me develop and create a new baking section of the business. So we were making our own breads. We made our own pies. We just started making so many new things.
And they hadn't been doing all that before you came.
No.
Wow. So you actually changed the whole business.
Yeah.
I remind listeners that I'm speaking with Amanda Kilbourne, who is the owner operator of Forest and Food Fixation. So your employer, you said, wanted to try out new things, but he had his own way of doing it. And what was that way? Later on, we'll talk about you don't do it that way. So how would he bring a new idea forward?
Pretty much any day. Yeah, he'd just come in and be like, you know what? I saw this online. I want to try it. And we'd go for it that day. No planning, just full right into it.
Straining.
He might have a recipe. He might not. He might ask you to get a recipe. So, a real think on your feet.
So how did you do that? I mean, initially it must have been a bit disconcerting, but you obviously worked out a way to deal with it.
Yeah, I found it very fun, not having to worry about the financial side of things. I was there getting paid. I was having fun. And inspiring, really, just to be able to play and change and, what's next?
And you're learning again that, as happens in all businesses, things come up, something happens in the community, something happens in the world around you, and that you have to say, oh, we can't do that anymore, and now we got to do something.
Yep.
Good training, training. Challenging at first, but good training.
Mm-hmm.
When you left the business, did you sort of see, I mean, I don't know if you kept in touch with your former employer, but did you have a sense that what you'd brought in was going to stick, that they were going to continue doing what you had trained them up to do?
They kind of fizzled out after I
did
left.
They? Yeah. Really?
I think after about a year, he pulled back and was just doing catering. The cafe closed. He was trying to sell it off to somebody else, and that didn't end up panning out. And he went fully into his catering business, and I'm not sure how much longer that went, but now he's running a granola business. He never stops, you know. Yeah.
Do you sense that he understood that you'd brought this whole new dimension to his work?
Yeah.
I mean,
there was an appreciation.
Was he grateful?
Yeah, there was an appreciation.
Oh, good. Sure. It's always important because it doesn't always happen that way.
No.
Now, somewhere along this time, your sister had come out to British Columbia, mm-hmm. and you came out.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like when you first arrived in this mountainous part of the world?
It was an adventure from the start because we were supposed to originally go up to Northwest Territories, and that's where we were going to go picking morel mushrooms. I grew after a forest fire, and there was a really good fire up there the year before, and then also some down in BC. Last minute, about 3 days before our trip, they're like, oh, actually, we're not going to go to Northwest Territories yet. We're going to do that in a month from now. We're going to actually go down to Mackenzie, BC.
Sure.
So my flight had a layover in Alberta, and her friend Lori came and drove all the way from the Yukon, dropped my sister off in Mackenzie, and went and picked us up, me and another friend, from the airport in Alberta, and then drove us all the way back. So, you know, just...
A wild time. You know, this country is big.
Mm-hmm.
When you went to Brazil, you traveled sort of the same distances going from one side of Canada to the other. I mean, it's a little bit longer.
It's a little bit longer.
And you cross the equator, and there are a few other things. But within this country, you can certainly do a lot of traveling and still be within its borders,
which is
quite astonishing.
It is.
Did you end up looking for mushrooms?
Yep, that was the whole point of the trip.
And how did it go? Did you find a pretty good supply?
I did, yeah. It's an interesting place to be out in the woods. We were camped out on an area where there's buyers for large companies set up to buy mushrooms from random hippies.
Would they have little tents and shelters and stuff like that?
Nothing set up for you. Yeah. You bring your own gear and you bring your own vagabond gear, style. You show up, you pick mushrooms, bring a basket to these guys, and they give you money for it. So as a way to play for a trip for myself out of the woods, it was pretty fun and a little bit addicting. So I had to do it again the next year and the next year.
We sense the fixation starting to build.
Yeah, pretty quickly.
What was it like for young women being out? I've had patients and people we've known in the community here who have done it, and they said it's pretty rough and tumble. You don't always feel that secure. What was that part like for you? Did you have to think about that?
Definitely be conscious of that, yeah. We never camp alone. We'd have a good amount of friends around us in a kind of a group. There's some sketchy people in the woods.
Yeah.
Anybody can go out there. So there's no, like, there's a bit of a lawlessness to it.
Yeah.
A little bit of a Wild West kind of vibe. Yeah.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that. And as a result, there's also a competition for finding the best spot. Sometimes people go back year after year to the same spot.
Oh, yeah. There's been stories about people having axe fights and different things. And
no, I had a patient once who was practically killed by somebody whacking him over the head.
Yep.
And he wasn't, he continued, but he suffered serious brain damage as a result of it.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it's a frontier kind of activity in some ways, but it's also bears with it risks that are not part of what most people expect a job to be. Like somebody come around the corner with a club or something like that.
And that's why you always go out in pairs or groups and have walkie-talkies and safety gear and GPS systems so you don't get lost.
Sure, sure. Modern devices are very useful like that. So you didn't stay this time. You went back to Ontario, but then you came back.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a process where you got back to the eastern side of the country and said, oh, there's something out there I think I'd like to go, or was it just on a whim?
The first time I went, it was only for 2 weeks. I got a taste for it. And so the whole next winter, my sister and me planned to do a sister trip across. So we drove across together and spent 3 months out there again. And then I had to go back to my home back there. But by the end of that 3 months, I already decided that I was like, yep, I'm going to go pack up and save up some money. And the next spring, I went back out with another friend.
And then you started working at different kinds of jobs. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing lots of people have said is you try lots of different kinds of jobs, mm-hmm. and then you find out not just what you like, but also what you don't like. So a number of things you had working in restaurants, being a barista. Did mm-hmm. you do those fancy little designs on the top of the coffee?
Yeah.
Probably easy to do, but it always amazes me. And other kinds of retail. And what did you learn that you liked and didn't like about work, the way you wanted to work and what it was important to you?
Over the years, I've, you know, witnessed a lot of different managerial styles and the ways that people run their business and the ways that people work with their employees. And I've taken some great things from them and then some less good things from them that I don't want to be. And also just the ways that you run your business and manage and deal with people.
Yes.
They're the most important part of my business. I wouldn't be able to run it without the employees that I have now.
Yes. A sense of gratitude towards people who come and put their best effort into something that matters to you and that matters to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing, and it's something that is possible in a small community-embedded business. It almost comes naturally mm-hmm. if you are aware of it, that you treat the people who work for you as people who work with you rather than being sort of a separate class of people. So then you got around to starting up a bit of business mm-hmm. of your own. Started small, I believe it was 2018.
Yeah, I think so.
What was quoting you from your notes.
Yeah, I know. My gauge of time isn't always perfect. But
that's all right.
It's probably good.
As a physician, my gauge of time is, I use my notes a lot to find out when things happen.
Yeah.
But what was your first venture?
So it was the morels. I started in the spring picking morels, fiddleheads, and some other wild foods, and brought them to market to sell, and very quickly realized and kind of had the forethought of, this is not going to be something I can facilitate all the time, especially being new to the area.
It's also seasonal.
It's seasonal, yeah. So there's a lot of stuff, and even now, there's since 2018, I've learned more about what is available out here to Wild Forage. So my availability for that stuff has increased. But at the time, especially, I needed something supplementary. So it's like, okay, well, I brought morels to market. I didn't sell them all. What am I going to do with them?
When you say market, was that a farmer's market?
Farmer's market.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
The Sorrento Village Farmer's Market,
okay.
Actually. I've been there ever since. And so I'd have extra morels or extra whatever. I'd incorporate that into baked products. So if I have a bunch of extra fruit or berries, that goes into muffins. If I have a bunch of wild mushrooms left over, I'll dry them and then add them into my breads or make little mushroom buns or, you know, just get creative with that and make up more food items. And then pretty quickly, the bread kind of took over and became the staple. And then now the mushrooms and foraged ingredients are a bit more supplementary, and I'm hoping to bring them back a little bit more.
The name that you chose, mm-hmm. apart from the fixation part, which we sort of got that figured out, but the name you chose, obviously you were trying to say this is...
It's
two worlds coming together. Yeah. How satisfying is that, to have almost like two parts of your life experience blended together into one business? I mean, it's a business.
It's pretty satisfying. It also keeps me engaged because of the seasonality of the foraged stuff. It keeps me from being bored.
Mother Nature has that capacity. She doesn't do the same thing twice.
Yeah.
When did the Salmon Arm Economic Development Society and their creation that has become a real fixture in this community, the Zest Food Hub, mm-hmm. become part of what you're doing? Did you know about when you first started your business?
I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
Zest Food Hub, I was one of their first tenants, but I was pretty quickly jumping in on that. Mm-hmm. I heard about it the whole year before they opened the doors.
Right.
And I was trying to find the person, and I think they had management switch around a few times before they found Tracy, who took over it for the first few years.
Yes.
And
Tracy?
Yep.
Yeah.
She did great. And as soon as I got in contact with her, she actually found me at the market one day and was like doing a bit of advertising, and I'm like, yes, please. I need a kitchen now.
Yes.
I was just expanding. Yeah. And so it was perfect timing.
That would have been 2021, 2022, something like that.
I think it was 2020. 2022. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. One of those.
One of those years in the past. And what happened? You went there?
Yep. You I went there. I checked it out. It was very intimidating. Big, giant, crazy kitchen.
The main one they have
the
there.
Their main rental.
It is pretty impressive.
Yeah. It's got a little bit of everything.
A lot of stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
Woof. A whole room full of stainless steel.
Much bigger than anything I've had. So, you know, it felt very serious all of a sudden. I had to swallow that a little bit.
Was this more, compare this to the cooking facilities you had in the restaurant in Toronto and the place where you change things. Was that less intimidating than what you saw in the Zest?
I think the difference is it was taking the business to a point of like, oh, this is real. Before it was in my home kitchen. So it felt more hobbyist.
Yeah.
And then that, yeah, switching over to a functional, real, commercial kitchen space. That's mine. That's my responsibility. That's a whole other level of intensity.
Yeah, there's no mistaking. It's the real McCoy. This is not.
Yeah.
This is not joking. So, when did the title and the formal structure of your business become established? Was it then, or had you already?
I had the name for years, and I registered everything in 2022. So it's not even that old in that respect, yeah.
So what's the process of registering? Because there's probably lots of listeners who would like to understand how you get a business started in that formal sense. How do you register a business?
You register with your local, it's been 2 years and I don't remember.
Well, that means you've moved on.
Yeah, well, I've done it. No,
paperwork. There's a bunch of paperwork.
It's paperwork, yeah.
And who does it work with, the municipality or the provincial or the federal? Or?
I'm registered with our local representatives.
Of the provincial? Probably provincial. I would guess it's provincial. I mean, nonprofit societies register provincially.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, we'll assume that it's not a problem. That was the least of the issues that you had to deal with when you were starting your business up.
Yeah, more of it was finding the correct space, having equipment, and
indeed. Yeah, we'll talk about that. I think that's an important thing to talk about. Just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Amanda Kilbourne, who is the owner-operator of Forest and Food Fixation. So there you are. It's finally happened. This is your show. What was the sort of overall sentiment you had? Obviously, it must have been some excitement.
Oh, excitement, yeah. Yeah. Once I actually got my real little kitchen set up, and I rented out their main big kitchen there for a little while at Zest, and then we created my own little pocket kitchen there.
What was that transition like, going from this giant, and you said somewhat intimidating array of high-volume cooking equipment, to have a smaller space that was designated for you?
The smaller space is better for us because it's specialized and created to be exactly what I need to function in my business. Mm-hmm. The big space is great for people just starting out, just because it has a little bit of everything. So depending on what you're doing, you can probably use that space and it can be very helpful for you. They actually have two now. They have a smaller one. And if I was starting again, I'd probably use the smaller one. It's more geared towards what I need. Versus a big open range and everything, a bunch of equipment in the big space that I would never use. And now my little pocket kitchen there is really functional. They have refrigeration space there now, which has expanded our ability to
that big
produce
reefer
more.
Truck out in the back. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's made it. That I remember when it came in, and it was really kind of an exciting experience for the people running Zest, for Tracy and the others. It was like, wow.
I was excited. I was pushing for it the whole time. Yeah.
You want it hot sometimes and you want it cold other times.
Yeah, temperature control is very important in bread making. Yeah.
What would your trajectory in running a business have been like if the Zest hadn't been there?
Oh, well, I don't know. I'd probably have been looking for some kind of more permanent space for me before. I needed something right around the time that I jumped in there. I was looking for any kind of rentable kitchen space. So I was looking at other resources in the area, like community centers. And that's really all there was for kitchen rentals. And they're not suited for commercial production. You have a whole little tiny home oven. You know, we bake 100 loaves plus a day or more. And then a bunch of other stuff on top of that. So you can't produce that out of a tiny home oven.
So it would have been really hard to start your business up without
to grow and expand. Yeah, it would have been quite limiting unless I was able to financially afford that having that stepping stone of Zest and having the rental kitchen and then being able to create and slowly make my own room and slowly add stuff to it. Yeah. It makes the financial aspect more approachable.
And the fact that it's publicly funded mean you're not having to deal with an employer who says, well, I'm going to sell the business, you know, the space that you're in now, so sorry, you got to go. It's, you know, it's going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't, there's a sense of continuity. There's also a sense of collaboration. There's
100%.
Lots of people working there doing the same kind of thing. What's that like, that atmosphere?
It's so fun. I have friends that come and go all the time and use the rental space, and I have friends down the hallway, so we often trade our food products. So it's like, oh, you need a little bit of bread? Great. And you need some pastries? You need some sausage? You need some, you know, there's so many different people working out of that space. We help each other, and it's nice. I like it a lot.
There's lots of businesses that don't have that.
Yeah.
And it means that you're operating on your own. There's a sense of isolation.
Yeah.
It's kind of a neighborly atmosphere, as I understand it.
Yeah, at least from my experience, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think that's another thing that small community-based businesses of all sorts end up finding. You reach out because you're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done a recent survey of businesses in the community, asking them what life had been like over the last few years, because there was, of course, the pandemic, and then there was the underpass being built under the railroad. And a lot of them talked about how much on the street, when they have a block-long row of businesses, they're not all doing the same thing. But they find that it's helpful to work together, you know, to shovel each other's sidewalks. And if there's a particular kind of package that somebody doesn't have enough of, they can get some from somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of atmosphere, how important has that been for you to feel secure in your business?
Just being in this community and its supportive nature is the way that my business has grown. I wouldn't have it otherwise. Like, some of the first customers of mine were friends or people that I knew from working at the coffee shops here. Customers of mine that I got to know over the years. And people are so eager in this community to help each other out and support. Like, you see a new small business open, it's lined up down the block the day that they open. It doesn't even matter what it is. Every time it's so fun. Yeah.
Yeah, we had the owner operators, the Anvil, talk about that. They accidentally had their first day on the day the farmer's market was on.
Yes.
And all the customers at the farmer's market came over and swamped them. They were like, how do we deal with this? And then they had that was their soft opening, and then their hard opening, whatever you call it, was on the Monday. And by then everybody knew about them.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, we're in. When you started to run your own business, and then we started to actually hire people, which is a whole new experience. You're the employer rather than the employee. What was that like, and what did you bring to it from what you'd been doing already?
When I have my employees, I do try my best to create a space where they're going to succeed. So if I have employees come in, I try to put them in positions where I know that they're going to do well and that they enjoy it as well. And teach them skills as they go along as well.
Was that hard or easy? I mean, you'd already got to know a few people and you'd had your smaller scale business for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Was it difficult, or was it pretty much just saying to people that you already knew, what about this, or they come to you, or what happened?
Most of my employees haven't been friends at first. They've been people that have applied or reached out. One of the girls I have with me now was one of my original hires when I started hiring, and she's come back. She went and had a baby, and then she's came back this spring. And now we're working together on creating new products and new things all the time.
Where do you advertise for businesses? Is there a directory where you say employees wanted, or
I just
handbills?
I throw stuff up on social media. That's it. I don't usually need a lot, or I just, you know, if somebody's already following me on Instagram and is interested in my business and wants to get their hands on some dough, then I'm happy to work with them.
Yeah. Giving new meaning to the word dough. We need more dough.
Yes.
It's not.
Yes.
It's real dough.
They get their hands on some dough, and then later they get some hands on some other dough. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Part of the dough exchange. What would you say as you get new people to be hired? Mm-hmm. How do you approach that? I know you told me when we spoke before the show that you do it one at a time. Mm-hmm. Sort of, it's not, you know, five people coming in or three people coming in at the same time or whatever. It's an individual process. Why is that important?
Because each person is an individual. And I want to, you know, engineer, not just, you know, come in, this is the job. It is. But at the same time, I want to know this person and I want to know what they can functionally do and happily. So, if they have, you know, something that they're bringing in that's a new skill, then we'll try to fit that into what we're doing too.
Are you ever reminded of that job you had in Toronto where things were thrown in your lap, but your employer's brother mm-hmm. saved your bacon by saying, well, you can do, she's good at this, why don't we yeah. give her that job? You're doing that with each employee as they come in. Yeah. You're doing it as a deliberate act. You're not saying...
Not as reactionary. It yeah, is yeah. intentional, yeah.
And have you found out as a result that you have people coming to work for you and with you who have interesting new talents or attributes or qualities or interests?
Mm-hmm, definitely.
How does that affect the business? Does it make it, you know, like your business in Toronto, which mm-hmm. while you were there was much expanded and then when you left it sort of shrank down, but you're here and it's a different kind of business entirely.
Yeah.
Do you find that employees come in and they have a new angle and you say, oh, that's a thought?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I want them to have fun.
So
come and play with food.
Why don't you describe something like that where somebody's come along and they say, well, I'm really interested in this. And you say, oh, well, that's interesting. Maybe we could incorporate that into something we do.
Oh, all the time. It just happens every day. one of my previous employees was like, you know what would be really good in this brioche dough is making pizza buns out of it. I'm like, you know, facepalm moment. Of course. Yeah. Why didn't? Of course. That sounds amazing. Why haven't we done that for years? And I'm so open to any kind of, you know, I'll show them the way that I make things and just do things. And if they come in and they're like, you know what, I tried it this way and it worked a little bit better for me. I'm like, amazing, great. Please do that every time. Please show me how to do it. Yes. You know, allow them to make their space comfortable. Every time I have an idea, we have a group chat, or if somebody else has an idea, we throw it on there and it's like, oh yeah, okay, this is how we could do that. And we work together to make it happen.
Obviously, your mother was working with kids who you had to adapt to. You had to find out what they could or could not do. Do you ever think that might have had an influence on just kind of a mindset that you were not necessarily conscious of, but just fitted in?
I don't think I was able to see that from my mom and in her workplace necessarily. I don't remember a lot of that except for from a very young age. Mm. But just in the way that she raised me... you know, and worked with me in the same way that she does in her work, with a lot of permission and a lot of understanding and communication. Definitely, that's affected the way that I then give that to others.
So what kind of feedback do you get from an employee? You know, you've had one who went away to have a child and then came back to work mm-hmm. for you again. It sounds like they like working with you.
I hope so.
Well, you know, people often talk about the job they have and, you know, they seek retirement mm-hmm. because they really like to stop working at the kind of job they're doing.
Yeah.
But your folks are understanding that you really want them to thrive in the business as well as the business itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, well... Good on you. I think that's the way all businesses should run. Anybody out there who's running a business, you can.
Sure.
Amanda's got a little model here that you might pick up on. Now, you've gone from 3 days a week to 5 days a week. You have 2.5 part-time employees.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen a half an employee.
Well,
I know what you mean.
Yes, that one's the part-time. Yeah.
Yes. So what's the range now with this kind of mix, this kind of ferment, I'm sorry to use baking terms, of you and your employees and the market and the community. What kind of stuff are you producing now? What's your range?
For our product? It's muchly geared towards the bread still. and our sourdough is our biggest sellers. Other than that, we get creative with our flavors still seasonally. So we had this spring when we had all of the morels coming out in the spring and everybody was going out picking them. I had our wild mushroom bread out on the market stands. And my one employee, she's really interested in making more pastries. So I give her as much free rein as possible. We're also developing a new granola recipe. Just playing still.
Playing. Yeah. George Burns, the comedian, when he was 90, was speaking to some seniors group, I think, telling jokes and standing on stage. And he stopped in the middle of his, said, you know, this is ridiculous. Here I am, 90 years old, standing up in front of a bunch of people and telling jokes, and they pay me.
Yeah.
It sounds like the way this your business works is as important as the fact that, you know, it has to make money. It has mm-hmm. to have a sort of a profile to do that. Now, farmers markets, you commented in the Salmon Arm Economic Development Society mm-hmm. page how important farmers markets are yeah. and how Salmon Arm is kind of situated in a place to take advantage of a number of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Anybody who lives within this area has access to, as a small business, farmers markets every day of the week almost. So if you have the ability to produce and sell like that, our system is a little bit more challenging. We have like a two-day bread making process, so we can only do so many markets. But there's ones in Salmon Arm, there's ones in Sorrento, you got Revelstoke not too far away, then down to Enderby and Armstrong, you know.
You cover the territory.
Yeah.
Just remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Amanda Kilbourne, the owner and operator of Forest and Food Fixation. Just want to go back to something you said about your employees. Mm-hmm. You said if one of my employees wants to take a day off for some reason, some personal reason, I say fine. I mean, you don't say fine if there's a big truck weighing out to take stuff away. But yeah. It's interesting. That contrasts so markedly with the way taking a day off, say, even an interior health authority or a corporate setting or any other kind of more formal and fixed kind of employment setting. Mm-hmm. You go through paperwork, you have to sign off, you have to get a doctor's note, you have to do all sorts of stuff. To me, it seems that you have this, because you know your employees better. And there are some small businesses where mm-hmm. they also are not, you know, well, we got production we have to do, you know. That flexibility seems to me kind of a critical thinking in the way you run your business. It's sort of like a central feature of what you do, allowing that kind of fluidity.
Yeah. If an employee needs a day off for whatever reason it is, and they ask about it ahead of time, or if it's last minute, something has come up, I'm not going to force them to work.
Yeah.
You know, we'll adjust. We'll make less bread. And we'll make a little less money that day. But we're also saving because they're not there. You know. But I don't want to force somebody to come and work for me who's not going to be happy to be there.
For sure.
Because if you're miserable being at work because you're missing out on this thing, you know, you got your whole life. Go live your life. Be here when you want to be here. And if, you know, you don't want to be here every day, then maybe you won't work here, but
maybe I'll come and work for you, Amanda. Although, actually, being a physician, you get lots of freedom. I think I may stick with what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But I would say that my employees have been with me for decades, mm-hmm. and I really value their work. So that relationship of mutual appreciation, I think, is critical. As is probably the most important thing in a workplace. Okay, what's your most popular product?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, well,
I have people come up to me at the farmer's market and they're like, which one's your favorite? I'm like, I made all of these. I engineered all these recipes to be something
all good.
I like.
They're
so
all
I'm
lovely.
Like,
yes.
I'm not going to be helpful for you. This is the wrong
So
person.
If you had to define your own favorite, the one that you would be most likely to eat.
That's the same question. I love my bagels. I like the white sourdough. I mean, it's just the traditional. Yeah. It's good. I like my sesame poppy seed bread. That one's actually less popular, but I don't know why. Mm. I should ask people.
It should be popular. You should tell people.
Yeah.
You should like this.
That one's my favorite, so what's wrong with you all? No, but, you know, people have different preferences.
And Ask Yous is now selling some of your products as well.
Oh, yeah, since 2022.
The very beginning. Any other retailers involved in what you're doing?
Yep, we have the Village Grocers out in Blind Bay and Sorrento. Eagle Bay brings our product in seasonally. So during their slow season right now, winter, so they've pulled back, but they'll probably jump in on it again next spring. And then we do the farmers markets and a couple of restaurants too. So Timber and Spinnaker's in Blind Bay both use our products. And we had a food truck this past season, the Between the Breads. They were awesome to work with. Mm. Hopefully they come back and do another season. And a couple small businesses too, like Still Foods Bistro and the Eco Treats Cafe uses some of our sourdough for their grilled cheese. Mm. Yeah.
Do you just kind of wander around and say, we do bread, we'd like some? How does it work?
For sales. I'll have to be doing some sales again soon, so I'll let you know later. It's been a bit. A lot of the times my clients have come to me. It's been pretty good.
Now, you also, when you had this immersive learning experience, learning how to teach small children stuff in Brazil, you found that you like teaching, the process of helping people learn. And you do that now, too. What sort of stuff are you doing there in teaching? It's an off-season thing, too.
Yep, it's seasonal. Yep. Yeah. So I do mushroom classes in the fall. I just finished it a couple of weeks ago. I love it. I just get to wander around the woods with a group of people and talk to them about one of my fixations. So, and they all want to listen. It's wild.
You're
so
in the forest talking about food. And
yeah, it's good.
I think you started a business.
Yeah, right.
You did.
I did, yeah.
So what kind of atmosphere or reception do you get? How do you advertise your classes?
Well, the classes are actually run, those ones are run through a separate company. They've hired me on. It's just a nice, easy job for me to jump into seasonally. I just show up and talk about mushrooms, and they've run all the paperwork and advertising.
Oh, that's nice. What's
Elements Adventures is the company. Okay. They mostly run canoe and kayak tours throughout BC seasonally.
Yes.
They're a great company. Mm. Yeah, I work with them every fall.
And their whole work would be connected to the same physical place where you like to be.
Exactly. The synergy.
Do you need any teaching in Salmon Arm? I know that the Shuswap Food Action Society has had a series of courses at the Buckerfields.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done any of that yet?
I haven't done that, but I do teach bread courses as well. And that's seasonal too. Usually we don't do any classes during the summer because we're very busy. This is a tourism city area, you know, so we're quite packed with work. But when it's nice and slow in the winter, I just last weekend did a sourdough demystified course, which teaches you the basics and walks you through the whole process of making your own dough and sourdough and baking and everything. And then you get to go home with some bread.
We had a vintner here who talked about the fact there are 5,000 wild fungi, that make wine. There's a few that make bad wine, but the overwhelming majority. And it was quite surprising to me to learn that a lot of bread was baked without adding yeast. I mean, Mother Nature would add the yeast.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit? Because that's where sourdough often has its connection.
Yep, sourdough is just a natural yeast. It is created using the flour and water, and it is for fermentation process. And you have to, you know, keep it fed regularly. You hear about how arduous that process is, and it doesn't have to be. We'll go over that in my class. But basically, you're building this yeast culture and feeding it regularly so it can stay active and happy and be fed. Just like anything in the world that's living. And it slowly ferments and creates this natural yeast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the purity laws in Germany for making beer included no yeast. Mm-hmm. That was because Mother Nature's out there working on their behalf. Now, you have another hobby that we talked about a little bit before the show, and that is a hobby where you take very sharp, pointed objects and you make them.
Yes.
You make knives.
Yes.
How did that happen? You told me your father actually had a forge in his garage. Now, that's getting very serious to have a forge. I mean, you might be worried you burn your garage down, but you can do it safely. So what's that like? How's that come about, and what do you do?
Well, the first time we did it, we were doing it as a family activity, but he built with his buddies, a ramshackle forge with a hair dryer and an old barbecue and some other stuff and an old anvil. Yeah, so we took some rail ties and heated them up and hammered them out and made some rustic-looking knives and axes. And it's not very useful, but it looks menacing, so it's pretty good in the woods anyway. And that's a long process, and it's a lot of work. And since then, I've started making knives just cutting metal. Mm. So I'll take old saw blades or old pieces of metal that my dad has found and cut them into specific shapes that I enjoy and then work them until they're the nice
specific shape. Knife shapes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then create the handle and everything.
So they would be flat. They would not have a taper.
Yeah. They're already and then I have to create the bevel. Yeah.
Yes. And apparently when you've been out in the woods, you have a little holster and your knife is right there.
Yeah.
There it is. You've got it with you.
Yeah, of course.
All right, everybody. You won't be able to see this, but Amanda is showing us this beautifully shaped knife, which has got, it's got a very interestingly tapered
round bulbous handle.
Yes, bulbous. We'll use the word bulbous here. And it's also got a notch here. Mm-hmm. It's got a notch close to the handle. What's that notch for?
It was just part of the metal.
Oh, so it was there.
There was a hole there.
Haven't you found a use for it? I could see you catching things. And
well, not so much that, but it is just a nice finger hold.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
But
and it's quite small. I would say the whole thing is probably less than 6 inches long.
It's
like 4.5.
It's a nice little pocket knife, and I've used it all season for foraging.
Yeah.
I made this one last winter with...
So do you keep it... Chefs, in particular, are notorious for keeping their knives painfully sharp.
No.
So Amanda just tapped her palm with it and nothing happened. There's no blood on the floor of sports fans.
It could use a sharpen. It's just been out in the woods with me. But
what you're doing with your business is part of a whole process of relocalization, of businesses not bringing stuff in from 5,000 kilometers away or across an ocean. What's it like to be part of that? I mean, in terms of your whole feeling about food and creating food and preparing food and delivering food. What's it like to be part of that movement?
It's pretty great. very intentional too. We, especially in the shoe shop here, there's just so much food available. There's so many farmers and so much wild foods that I, forage and utilize, but we use local eggs and milks and vegetables and things in the summer when we have access and use things as seasonally as possible. And support each other.
In Mother Nature, the world of nature, people talk about a web of life, the web of life. And our indigenous friends and neighbors have been trying to tell us about this for a very long time, and we've been sort of ignoring them. But now we're not, thank heavens. It's kind of like a social web.
Yep.
You've got a kind of community of like-minded people who supply one another with something that the other person needs and take from somebody else something they need, that kind of thing. What's that like, having this kind of community sense as well?
I think that's really what helps the small businesses in this area thrive. I go to the farmers markets and I know half the people there, even if I haven't been to that farmers market, because everybody cycles together and works together. And it's so cool to see.
Farmers markets have a nice atmosphere.
They do, yeah.
They're really friendly. People talk about knowing their grower or knowing their producer.
Mm-hmm.
And you've described that in terms of people you've hired and also people that you've had, buying your what you produce. How does that play into the feeling you have living this part of the world?
I think it's incredibly important for a lot of, as somebody who's producing and seeing people buy from me, being at the farmers markets is how my business grew altogether. So people having a face to the person producing what they're making, it's not just a piece of bread. It's not just a piece of food. It's like, I know that this person.
It's Amanda's bread.
Yeah, there's a personality behind it.
Yeah.
So it's not it's a connecting agent for people. You know, they appreciate the value of that much more.
You know what you're doing is really what our program is all about: mm-hmm. fostering food, not just security, but food sovereignty, having the kind of food that you really like.
Yeah.
It's really been wonderful having you here, to hear you talk about putting into action kind of a dream in by degrees, you know, one step at a time. And it's really been very helpful, I think, to a lot of people to hear what you've had to say. And we're very grateful to have you come in. So thanks very much, Amanda, for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.